This is Radio Democracy, a series of 12 commentaries by the noted author and political analyst Michael Parenti. This segment is titled, Who Governs? Who makes the decisions and occupies the positions of power in the USA?
Alexis de Tocqueville once said that the wealthy have little desire to govern the working people. They simply want to use them. And yet, members of the owning class seldom have been slow in assuming the burdens of public office. Not every important political leader is rich, but many are, and those who are not are usually beholden to money interests. Not all wealthy persons are engaged in ruling. Many prefer to concentrate on other pursuits like leisure. The ruling class consists largely of the politically active members of the owning class, plus new and faithful recruits from below, such as Ronald Reagan, Richard Nixon, Henry Kissinger, Bill Clinton. All of them came from very modest backgrounds, Lyndon Johnson, but they ended up being millionaires. Helping and serving the rich usually ends up with you yourself being rich. From the beginning of the Republic to modern times, the top leadership positions, including the presidency, vice presidency, the president's cabinet, and the Supreme Court, have rested predominantly in the hands of white males from wealthy families, with most of the remainder being of upper middle class origin, that is, moderately successful business people, commercial farmers, and professionals. Legend has it that many U.S. presidents rose from humble origins. In fact, almost all came from families of a higher socioeconomic status than about 90% of the U.S. population. In recent times, political leaders have been drawn from the directorships of big corporations, prominent law firms, Wall Street banks, and less frequently from the military, elite universities, think tanks, foundations, and scientific establishment. More than a third went to elite Ivy League schools. The men who ran the nation's defense establishment in the decades after World War II were so like one another in occupation, religion, style, and social status that apart from a few Washington lawyers, Texans, and Mavericks, it was possible to locate the offices of all of them within 15 city blocks in New York, Boston, and Detroit. So says Richard Barnett in his book Roots of War. The wealthy carry into public life many of the class interests and values that shape their political careers. For the most part, the plutocracy recruits its top members from its own social class. The crucial factor, however, is not the class origin of leaders, but the class interests they serve. The question is not only who governs, but whose interests and whose agenda are served by who governs, who benefits, and who does not. Government and business elites are linked by institutional, financial, and social ties, and they move easily between public and private leadership posts. One of the most prominent policy advisory groups, which forms an interlocking network of corporate and political notables, is the Council on Foreign Relations, started in 1918 by J.D. Rockefeller, Nelson Aldrich, J.P. Morgan, and other moguls. It consisted primarily of prominent individuals drawn from financial, industrial, and state. The council has some 1,450 members, almost half of whom are listed in the social register. They come from elite families. Almost half of them come from families of inherited wealth. Over 60% are corporate lawyers, executives, or bankers, including representatives from the Rockefeller, Morgan, and DuPont groups. The private companies that have had most council members are Morgan Guaranty Trust, Chase Manhattan Bank, Citibank, and IBM. In recent decades, council members have included U.S. presidents, secretaries of state, defense, cabinet members and their top officers, secretaries of the Army, Navy, and Air Force, members of the Joint Chief of Staff, national security advisors, CIA directors, federal judges, Federal Reserve officers, and scores of U.S. ambassadors and officers of U.S. Agency for International Development and other agencies, scores of U.S. House and Senate members, executives and directors of almost all the major banks and leading corporations. All of these people have been members of the Council for Foreign Relations, including numerous college and university presidents, publishers, editors, newscasters, columnists, and media commentators from every major news organization in the country. The Council on Foreign Relations has played a crucial central role in formulating U.S. foreign policy. It was a major force in creating the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. It advocated a strategic nuclear arsenal, U.S. global interventionism after World War II, military action in Guatemala, military escalation in South Vietnam, and eventual diplomatic relations with China. In 1980, the Council strongly recommended a sharp escalation in military spending and a harder line toward the Soviets. All of these positions I just listed were eventually adopted by whomever was in the White House, regardless of political party. Some Council members also belonged to the Trilateral Commission, an assemblage of economic and political leaders from the major industrial countries, initiated by David Rockefeller for the purpose of coordinating and protecting international capitalism in a changing world. A similar international organization is the Bilderberg Conference, which each year brings together state leaders, financiers, military commanders, and prominent politicians, along with a sprinkling of academics and publicists from around the world. There's the Business Roundtable. There's the Business Council, the latter composed of 154 representatives from such companies as Chase Manhattan Bank, Morgan Guaranty Trust, General Electric, and General Motors. The Business Council holds regular three-day secret meetings with top government officials in a posh hotel just outside of Washington, D.C. Rather than promoting the interests of particular enterprises, these various ruling class organizations seek to develop policies to serve the overall system. In other words, they're not lobbyists for General Electric in particular or General Motors in particular. They're there to make the whole system safe for all the Fortune 500. Instead of being special interest lobbyists, they are corporate class policymakers. Their overall influence is drawn from the persuasiveness that inheres in the enormous economic power they wield. Their direct influence is realized in their capacity, which, by the way, is unique among all social and political groups in America, their extraordinary capacity to fill top government posts with persons from their ranks or persons devoted to their interests. The names of the players change, but the game remains much the same. President Ford appointed 14 Council on Foreign Relations members to positions in his administration. 17 top members of the Carter administration were trilateralists, including President Carter himself and Vice President Mondale. President Reagan's administrators included chief executives of Wall Street investment houses and directors of New York banks. At least a dozen of them and 31 advisors were members of the Council on Foreign Relations. Most of President Bush's cabinet consisted of corporate leaders who were also Council on Foreign Relations members and some trilateralists. Bush himself was a former trilateralist. President Clinton's administration offered more gender and racial diversity than was usually found, but not much class diversity, not much political diversity. Clinton's top administrators were drawn from corporate America. Many were Council Foreign Relations members. Now, while still governor of Arkansas, Clinton himself was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He was a member of the Trilateral Commission, and he was a member of the Bilderberg Conference, having attended the latter in 1991 along with David Rockefeller. Well, do I have a conspiracy theory? Do I think that men sit around in a room plotting these things to rule the country? Well, they don't meet on park benches. They don't skydive from airplanes and talk. Of course they meet in rooms. They meet all the time. And of course they plot. They don't call it plotting. They call it planning. It's not a conspiracy theory. These are publicly known organizations, and their membership and their positions in government are a matter of public record. So even when it's a matter of public record, some people will deny its existence and accuse you of being a conspiracy theorist. Lobbyists also enter the picture. Lobbyists are persons hired by interest groups to influence legislative and administrative policies. Some political scientists see lobbying as part of the information process. So there are some political scientists who are dedicated to seeing a silver lining around every cloud, and anything that happens in the U.S. system is seen as being positive and serving a function. So with lobbyists. The office holder's perception of an issue is influenced primarily by the information provided. and the lobbyist's job is to be the provider. So therefore, this is a very creative and positive process, some observers say. But this process doesn't occur in a social vacuum. Often the arguments made on behalf of an issue are less important than who is making them and what interests he or she represents. Often the information that's supplied is highly skewed to serve a specific interest. It's not there to inform the office holder for the sake of informing him. It's there to win an argument and gain an advantage. As one congressional committee counsel explains it, there's the 23-year-old consumer lobbyist, and then there's the businessman who gives you $5,000. Whom are you going to listen to? Business lobbying has intensified over the last two decades. In 1971, less than 200 firms have registered lobbyists in the Capitol. A decade later, the number had grown to 2,000. By 1979, the American Petroleum Institute, an organization of big, powerful oil, gas, and petroleum and petrochemical companies, was spending $75 million in lobbying efforts. The entire oil industry employed over 600 people to pressure Congress and government agencies. Lockheed, a big defense contractor, currently maintains 135 lobbyists in Washington. Some of Washington's top lobbying groups are well funded by foreign governments, and these governments are among the world's worst human rights abusers, such as Turkey, Kuwait, Indonesia, Guatemala, Colombia, Saudi Arabia, and the CIA-supported UNITA rebel group, a bunch of murderers in Angola. These governments successfully lobby Congress for hundreds of millions of dollars in foreign aid, compliments of the U.S. taxpayer. The most effective resource lobbyists can have at their command is money. Money buys accessibility to the office holder, and beyond that, the opportunity to shape his or her judgments with arguments of the lobbyist's own choosing. Access doesn't guarantee influence. You can get to Washington and you can find you'll always be politely listened to. As Woodrow Wilson said, they'll listen to you, but the men who were really consulted are the men who have the big stake, the big bankers, the big manufacturers, the big masters of commerce. The masters of the government of the United States are the combined capitalists and manufacturers of the United States. That was former President Woodrow Wilson I was quoting, who said that in 1907. He didn't talk like that after he became president. In other words, it's something more than information flow that determines influence. The decisive factor is not the message, but the messenger. The ability to disseminate information to decision makers and propagate one's cause itself presumes organization, expertise, time, and labor, things that money can buy. In addition, the mere possession of great wealth and the control of industry and jobs gives corporate interests an advantage unknown to ordinary working citizens, for businesses' claims are paraded as the needs of the economy and, as it were, of the nation itself. Having the advantage of pursuing their interests within the framework of a corporate economy, corporate heads can pretty much limit the range of solutions. Surveying the organized interest groups in America, E.E. Schatzschneider notes that the pressure system is largely dominated by business groups. The majority of citizens belonging to no organization that is effectively engaged in pressure politics. So most of us are not represented by the 15,000 lobbyists that prowl the Capitol's corridors and lobbies. In fact, that's where they get their names from, their prowling of the lobbies. These lobbyists, what do? They seek favorable rulings from agencies within the vast executive bureaucracy and from Congress. Lobbyists make themselves so helpful that members of Congress sometimes rely on them to perform tasks that normally are done by congressional staffs. Lobbyists will draft legislation, write speeches, and plant stories in the press on behalf of cooperative lawmakers. Lobbyists put in millions of hours each year to make the world a better place for their clients, and they succeed on a scale that is undreamed of by most ordinary citizens. A favorable adjustment in rates for interstate carriers, a special tax benefit for a family oil trust, the leasing of public lands to a private company, emergency funding for a faltering aeronautics plant, a postal subsidy for advertising firms, the easing of safety standards for a food processor, the easing of pollution controls for a chemical plant, a special acreage allotment for tobacco growers, an investment guarantee to a housing developer. All these hundreds of bills and their thousands of special amendments and the tens of thousands of administrative rulings, which mean so much to particular business interests and arouse the sympathetic efforts of legislators and bureaucrats, will go largely unnoticed in the press, largely unnoticed by a public that pays the monetary and human costs and seldom has the means to make its own case or even to discover that it has a case. Almost all of these special measures are pursued by business. The same business that says we should have less government. It's ironic that business should say it when you think that business is more involved in government than anyone else ever could dream of being. Attempting to speak for the great unorganized populace, public interest groups make many proposals for reform but have few of the resources that push office holders in a reformist direction, especially when their proposals are directed against powerful entrenched interests in the economy. The multiplicity of interests within the business community creates problems of cohesion, but these diverse groups are capable of colluding around common class interests, as I pointed out. Thus we have things like the National Association of Manufacturers and the Chamber of Commerce, where all sorts of various interests collude and get together and back each other's bills against the public interest. Pressure group efforts are directed not only at office holders, lawmakers, and bureaucrats, but also at the public itself, in what's called grassroots lobbying. The goal is to create a general publicity campaign and media blitz to influence the lawmakers' sense of what should be done. The contest is a highly unequal one. Corporations and business associates have been able to spend over $1 billion a year on grassroots lobbying, whereas the combined expenditures of environmental, consumer, and other public interest groups comes to less than 1% of that amount. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce alone, with its thousands of associated businesses and $67 million annual budget, can bring down a snowstorm of mail and a mountain of pressure on lawmakers. In the summer of 1993, the National Association of Manufacturers launched a campaign that inundated Congress with letters and phone calls opposing President Clinton's proposed energy tax, and as a result, the plan was squashed. Interest groups sometimes hide behind front organizations that have uplifting public service-sounding names. For instance, the National Wetlands Coalition is a well-financed lobbying of giant oil companies, mining companies, and real estate developers with the mission of undoing the regulations that protect our wetlands. They should be called the National Anti-Wetlands Coalition. Some grassroots lobbying is intended to build a climate of opinion favorable to the corporate giants, rather than to push a particular piece of legislation. The steel, oil, and electronics companies do not urge the public to support the latest tax loophole bill or business handout. I mean, if anything, they would prefer that citizens not trouble themselves with such matters. But they do educate the public, telling of the many jobs they create, the progress and services they provide, the loving care they supposedly give to the environment, and all of this. This is called institutional advertising. It could also be called grassroots ideological lobbying. It's an attempt to place the desires of the giant firms above politics and above controversy and above control, a goal that is itself highly political. Rather than selling their particular products, the corporations sell the business system itself. Besides working the inside track of influence peddling, business does well in mass campaigns, using the power of money to harness the power of numbers. On occasion, progressive groups in various states are able to place referenda on the ballots supporting reform causes. Polls show that often these referenda are initially backed by large majorities, only to be voted down after public opinion is swayed by multi-million dollar media assaults launched by affluent interests. Increasingly, the referendum is being successfully employed by well-funded conservative organizations utilizing newspaper advertisements, radio and TV commercials, and using hundreds of millions of dollars to buy the time. We hear that the trouble is the unions are causing a lot of our trouble, and unions have been too strong. For years, conservatives would tell us that labor unions were corrupt, unpopular, harmful, and too powerful. The truth is something else. In 1947, a Republican-controlled Congress passed the Taft-Hartley Act, which imposed restrictions on strikes, boycotts, and labor organizing, resulting in a decline in union membership from 35% of the workforce to 16% by 1991. The number of strikes has dropped drastically as weakened unions have become less able to fight back. Union busting has become a major industry with more than 1,000 consulting firms doing a $500 million business every year, teaching companies how to prevent workers from organizing and how to get rid of existing unions. Industry also uses the threat of plant closings to extract from unions benefits and wage concessions amounting to billions of dollars. Under federal law, the National Labor Relations Board is an independent federal agency intended to protect labor's right to organize and deal with grievances against management. During the Reagan-Bush years, the NLRB was stacked with pro-business appointees who often refused to protect employees from being illegally fired from union activities, and who would impose only token fines on management for serious violations. During union election drives, management can propagandize workers as a captive audience and ply them with gifts to induce an anti-union vote. In contrast, union organizers are denied access to the worksite and are prohibited from giving gifts to workers. Management can threaten to move the plant if a union is voted in. About 10,000 workers a year are illegally fired for their union organizing activities. The NLRA right to organize, guaranteed under federal law, has become almost a dead letter. A company caught threatening a worker with dismissal for union activity suffers the heavy penalty of having to post a notice promising not to do it again. Throughout the 1980s and early 90s, owners have refused to negotiate contracts with unions. They've deliberately forced workers out on strike. When this happens, the company fires the strikers and brings in permanent replacements to break the union. This is why strike activity has fallen markedly. The threat of scab worker replacement, in effect, has eliminated the right to strike and seriously hampered the right to unionize. If unions are in decline, and they are in decline, 34% of the workforce was unionized in the 1950s. Today, it's down to about 15 or 14%. If they're declining, it's not because workers don't like them. By a margin of 60 to 23%, Americans believe unions have been good for working people. Almost 4 out of 5 citizens favor laws that would protect the right of workers to organize. The causes of decline are the repressive, one-sided conditions under which organized labor has been forced to operate. Far from having too much power, unions have been fighting for their lives. Some people complain that unions are corrupt and undemocratic. To be sure, some union leaders become union dealers, powerful and autocratic in relation to their own membership, voting themselves sumptuous salaries and colluding with gangland thugs to intimidate rank and file. And in return, they win management's ready acceptance as a union because they do very little for the membership and they cooperate with management. But this kind of corruption tends to be concentrated in less than 1% of all locals. In contrast, 60% of the Fortune 500's largest corporations have been guilty of fraud, bribes, illegal kickbacks, tax evasion, and other criminal acts. Business also plays fast with labor's money. During the 1980s, almost 2,000 companies removed $21 billion from employees' pension funds and stole additional billions by substituting inferior pension plans for the ones that workers had originally paid into. If unions are bad for the economy, we might expect that as they decline, the economy would flourish. But the very opposite has happened. Organized labor has lost membership from 1970 to 93, but there has been no great economic resurgence. Instead, there were several severe recessions. In states where unions have been traditionally weak, Alabama, South Carolina, and Mississippi, the standard of living has been lower than in states where unions have a strong presence. And so with the third world countries that have weak or non-existent unions as compared to the better unionized and more prosperous nations of Western Europe and Scandinavia. Unions correlate with prosperity rather than with poverty. Human labor is the basis of our well-being and survival. Everywhere in the world, in the United States, it deserves far better treatment than it is getting.
You heard Who Governs? Part 8 of a 12-part series of commentaries by Michael Parenti. Michael Parenti is author of many books, among them Democracy for the Few, Inventing Reality, Against Empire, and Dirty Truths. Here is a brief preview of our next issue of Radio Democracy.
We're told that our Constitution is a flexible one that grows with time. It's an elastic instrument. If it is, much of the stretching has been done by the 9 persons on the Supreme Court, and the directions in which they pull are largely determined by their own ideological predilections. As Chief Justice Hughes pointed out years ago, we are under a constitution, but the constitution is what the judges say it is. That's a direct quote. By its nature, the Supreme Court is something of an aristocratic branch of government. Its members are appointed rather than elected. They enjoy life tenure and are formally accountable to no one once in office, and they have the final word on constitutional matters and a great influence in their power to interpret the scope and intent of laws. Through most of its history, the court's personnel were recruited mainly from the class of corporate lawyers. Justice Miller, a Lincoln appointee to the court, made note of the judiciary's class biases. Quote, "It is vain to contend with judges who have been at the bar, the advocates for 40 years of railroad companies and all forms of associated capital. All their training, all their feelings are from the start in favor of those who need no such influence."
Michael Parenti coming up on the next segment of Radio Democracy. For a copy of this talk and one other by Michael Parenti, please send $4 for one cassette and ask for Part 8, Who Governs? For the entire 12-part series on 6 cassettes, send $24, that's 6 cassettes for $24, to People's Video Audio, Post Office Box 99514, Seattle, Washington 98199, USA. That's People's Video Audio, Post Office Box 99514, Seattle, Washington 98199, USA.